Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. This is Fergus in Chicago. Today, we're going to go through the second part of the Guinness Showcase. If you want to see the actual creative work that we've baked into the audio track here, you can actually go to our website at onstrategyshowcase.com, and you can see all of the cases there, including Guinness, and you can play the creative if you'd like to see that. Before we get started, I wanted to share a few things I feel this case study or this showcase kind of underscores for us as strategists. Firstly, brands need to be deeply understood by those who work on them. When I interviewed Craig, Allison, and Nick and heard them talk about the product and the brand, their understanding is amazing, and it's not simply superficial. It's sort of a depth of understanding that is passionate, it's distinctive, it's imaginative. And I think we all should be able to describe our clients' brands with such sort of clear visual language. And I think visual language being the most important factor. And I think, you know, for all of the interviews I've done, I think that the ability to do that and to have that deep understanding is how the best teams and the best brands are created. Secondly, I think changing tone and conceptual direction does not require changing a brand's platform. I think that's a very big learning from this Guinness showcase. I think that it's easy for us as strategists and as creative teams and as clients to feel that because something isn't performing up to standard, that the problem is the entire direction and not simply the idea of maybe some adjustments to the existing direction. So brands shouldn't be static. And, you know, for example, I mean, the fact that we all wear different outfits every day doesn't make us different people. It just expresses a different part of who we are and hopefully does it in a fresh way. So I think, you know, it's important to experiment. It's important to experiment with tone and with conceptual direction. And yes, I mean, stay true to your core platform, but play with its execution until you discover what works. And I think, you know, Guinness shifted conceptual and tonal directions 4 to 5 times during the period of time that we talk about in the showcase, which goes back to 2012. But it always stayed true to its platform. And then the third and final thing to underscore, I feel, is that effectiveness needs to be at the core of your strategic thinking. And I think as strategists, our job is not simply to inspire creative teams. It's really to generate results. So we can't forget this. And I think too many times we do. And creatives also need to be willing to enthusiastically change direction when results are weak and not to resist it. Because responsibility for performance doesn't live in one department. From my point of view, and I know it's tough because I mean I'm as guilty as this as any other strategist, but however, solving the problem of underperformance can be as exciting as solving the original brand challenge. It's just a matter of attitude. And Guinness did a fantastic job at this over the 8-year period we discuss, and it's why it has consistently won IPA Effectiveness Awards. So this is episode 2 of Guinness Made of More with Allison Falconer, Global Planning Director for Guinness and Beer at Diageo, Craig Maudsley, Co-Chief Strategy Officer at AMV BBDO London, and Nick Hulley, Executive Creative Director at AMV BBDO London. Enjoy. So welcome everybody to episode 2 of Guinness. And we're actually recording this right after the IPA Awards were announced, and both Diageo and the agency did fantastic with numerous awards. How does it feel for everybody to have that sort of recognition yet again? I could say, well done.
I know. I think it's been a great week for us. And as I say, just to pay particular tribute to Diageo, the commitment to writing these papers for IPA and the commitment to effectiveness and creative effectiveness from Diageo in general is just a joy to have as a client. Having, you know, they won across the board for Gordon's, for Bailey's, for their general approach to brand building and the dividends that's paid. And then of course for Guinness in particular, and it's Guinness's third gold award at the IPA Effectiveness Awards in a row. So we're thrilled, but as I say, it's great tribute to Diageo's commitment to continuing to enter and publish.
Well done, Alison. How does it feel?
I have to say the Diageo is buzzing with it. And that was a very humble way for Craig to talk about it. The guys at AMV wrote a great paper, and it's a hard slog, you know, getting the numbers lined up. We are fortunate that the business really does invest in understanding effectiveness. So it means that it's the data's there to show what we do. But I think being able to tell the story for the third time and show how we continue to move on was my highlight about this paper. But yeah, very proud, and also very aware that as a whole village made this, you know, we're talking about 8 years of different teams and different creative teams and different strategists. And it's the long-term story, as you know, Fergus, that actually makes this one special.
Because writing the paper is in of itself writing a strategy. I mean, you've in essence got to determine what you don't include, and that's got to be an incredibly difficult chore, is sort of figure out this set of decisions to make. Is like when you're looking back over 8 years, knowing what you have to exclude is a really difficult job. I've got to think. So well done. And these are not, for anybody who has not seen one of these papers, they're particularly with IPA, it's very detailed, and it's held to a very, very high standard. Congratulations. So for those who have not listened to episode one, I would encourage you to do that before you listen to this one, because it gives you a really extraordinary sense of where all of this started from. We started in episode one with the work starting with Clock and Cloud and Surge back in 2012 and 13. And we had a great discussion of how that evolved over time, right up to Compton Cowboys in 2018, and the articulation of the brand and the expression of it in all of those different creative executions. Craig, can you give us a sense of sort of a little summary of what the business and cultural landscape was like as we entered into this kind of third chapter, which was 2018, roughly then into 2019. What was happening that caused sort of a yet another, not an evolution? It wasn't because of mistakes made. It was just an evolution because things were evolving.
I mean, the fundamental business dynamics remained very much the same, which was a backdrop of an extremely challenging market that only became more challenging. So pubs, which, as we talked about before, are the kind of primary way to enjoy Guinness at its best, were continuing to close in both GB and Ireland. Beer as a category and the kind of mainstream big brand beer category was continuing to decline, both in absolute terms and as a share of the market, in favor of smaller brands, more interesting brands, more alternative choices. And there was also a broader cultural landscape that in some ways was also turning away from these older brands and turning away from drinking as a whole as well. Mm-hmm. We needed to find our appropriate place in that, whilst also ensuring that we were holding ourselves to the highest standards of kind of responsible marketing, you know, making sure that when people were choosing to drink, as perhaps they were doing a little less often than they might have done in the past, they were more often choosing a brand of great quality, which we would consider Guinness to be. And then the broader cultural landscape as well was characterized at this point by tremendous division, certainly in Great Britain, where, you know, Brexit and all the Brexit wars were kind of at their fullest height by 2018 and 2019, characterized by probably greater difference between individuals than we had seen in many generations. And when you consider that one of Guinness's core kind of values is communion and the ability to bring people together in wonderful and joyful ways, that presented both a challenge and an opportunity.
Alison, what did you see? Was there anything in addition to that you'd share?
I suppose some of the things we were picking up from qualitative research, you know how sometimes an anecdote sticks in your head just as something really illustrative. It was listening to guys in Manchester talking about drinking beer with more discomfort than I'd ever heard, that they were worried about looking a bit sort of rough, you know. Beer was okay for when you're playing pool with the guys, but if you're on a date, you didn't want to be the guy with a pint of that stuff. And their response to that was then to drink better beer, to look for things that were more premium, more stylish, things that were happening in pubs. Like if you go into a pub now compared to 10 years ago, the glassware on offer, there's this enormous range because everyone's trying to make their beer feel special and be very high quality and reassuring about the role of beer and what it looks like on you, the drinker. And I think we were feeling that pressure.
I remember you guys mentioned in the last episode that Guinness used to be the most interesting beer behind the bar, and that had changed. And I think about that in the U.S. and with the explosion of craft beers, where every story was a local story, that the complexity of beer had changed so much. And I was always very surprised when I went back to Ireland that Budweiser was such a major player in Ireland. I mean, it's a major brand over here, but it doesn't have any level of reverence to it. It had more reverence in Ireland than it did here in the U.S. So I've got to assume that were craft beers as much of an issue in Great Britain and Ireland at that time?
They were starting to be. I would say GB went first, and then it started to be more of an issue in Ireland as well in terms of that proliferation. But I think that what you were just saying about Budweiser is a story we see in nations all around the world, which is the big beer, the biggest beer, has lost its shine. So that's Budweiser in the USA, it's Snow in China, and for us in Ireland, it's Guinness. So Guinness in Ireland had that role of being the incumbent that felt a bit predictable almost at its worst. And we were also fighting that kind of pressure, perhaps with more to offer than maybe just a lager where they were everything's so similar. But we had that sense, especially with the younger generation, that maybe they were just, Guinness wasn't shining for them in the way it might have done for previous.
Nick, for you, what were your kind of observations of this once it came to your attention? And you were seeing it every day also, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think Alison has sort of hit the nail on the head with the anecdote from Manchester, that fear that there was a sort of a regressive masculinity issue there, that this is a heavily, but not, yeah, the codes of masculinity that sort of makes you feel that it's a little bit regressive. And so you sort of kind of going, how do you reinvigorate that? How do you open that up? How do you make it more accommodating? Because I suppose socializing is a universal concept. It's available to all of us and we all indulge in it. How do you just make that open invitation and take a little bit of that regressive masculinity away?
So when you talked earlier, Craig, about what was going on with Brexit and this sort of sense of division as a result of that, did that influence the way you told stories, or was that just something that was happening? Was there because Guinness was always about, as you said, communion and about sort of there was a joy to it, and there was a sense of celebrating your own path or carving out your own path. Was that influencing you strategically, or was it just an observation of what was happening in culture?
And I think anyone who's lived in GB in the last few years, that debate has influenced everything we think about. And whilst it might not have had an explicit direct response, it's just been the water we're swimming in the past few years, and this feeling of a nation divided. And interestingly, again, I was thinking of it as Alison was talking earlier around the pub. You know, pubs were a kind of crucible for a lot of these issues. I mean, famously, you know, Wetherspoons, which has been one of the biggest pub chains in GB for a little while, had used their beer mats to promote the Leave campaign, and, you know, to some controversy in question. You know, it was a sense where that debate and that sense of division and a feeling that we perhaps weren't as cohesive a nation as we previously had been was taking place in the pub where people were drinking the product. And so you couldn't ignore it. You didn't want to address it overtly, but you knew that there was this feeling of the people wanting something that would help bring people back together, people wanting something that would give a little light relief from some of this quite aggressive debate that was going on at times. Something that would give them a feeling of where we might get to in the future, where we could go, and the essential humanity that sits behind all that.
So when we're at 2018 and rugby becomes a very big part of the strategy for 2018, 2019. Had Guinness been a part of rugby in the past, or was this an all-new initiative for the brand?
I mean, rugby has played a huge role in kind of Guinness's heritage over time. I mean, it's observed that there are shared values between the two brands. We talked about last time Guinness's focus on power, goodness, and communion, and rugby has always had a great self-image and also a projected image of itself as being a game that is also about communion, also has a generosity at its heart, is very much about respect and integrity, and has a sort of a very different kind of profile than lots of other sports. The Irish heritage is part of it as well, of course, because rugby plays a different cultural role in Ireland, certainly, than it does in GB. And the two things had been intertwined, although often in a relatively informal way. What was coming towards us in the years that we're talking about here was a much bigger kind of formal connection through sponsorship connections that were about to be in the market.
Yeah, I think before we took on the sponsorship of the Six Nations, if you'd asked people which beer brands were in rugby, Guinness would have been at the top of their mind, right alongside Heineken, who had lots of sponsorship rights. But we'd been so active, we'd told such stories, we'd found other partnerships and ways in to, as Craig said, almost hijack it. It's also there because, we're not just talking about a few years here, we're talking about long-term, in some cases, grassroots connections to rugby clubs, right down to things like providing them shirts and putting fridges in the club room. But I think the opportunity was there to actually come to the front, be a leadership force in rugby, and proudly, you know, take on the sponsorship because it became available. It was a decision that had to be taken really fast because there was a very short turnaround on that availability of the Six Nations, which is the most valuable sponsorship property in Europe for us in rugby. And the business moved really fast to do it. And also to commit to it, and therefore to go deeper and make more of a difference with that investment.
So Craig, before we turn to Nick, can you tell us about what the brief was to the creative team and what form did it take?
I mean, I think when you're looking at sports briefs, there's always a number of different ways you can go, and I think a lot of them tell those stories of the extraordinary athleticism and feats of skill on the pitch or on the court. Whereas the focus for Guinness and the focus for Guinness around rugby was very much about the spirit of the fans and this sense that there was tremendous rivalry that might be happening on the pitch between the players, but that on the terraces and in the stadia, there was a huge affinity that went on between rugby fans of whatever club, of whatever nation. And it was that kind of combination of kind of rivalry and friendship, which would sit at the very heart of the brief. But it all happened, as Alison was saying, in record time. So I'm sure Nick will be able to give you some very interesting insights into how fast you can do these
amazing ones. I was going to say that it was a quick turnaround. We were sort of easing into Christmas, I think. I think it was the beginning of December when it was... we need a Six Nations campaign, which obviously kicks off in February.
And so for you, Nick, someone knocks on your door of your office or however that happens, and what's the conversation? Are there sort of strategic imperatives in it? Is there a proposition that you remember being presented with, or was it completely informal? Given that it was a sort of a rush situation,
it was a sort of a war room discussion of get everybody and say we've got the sponsorship is happening. It's a big investment, so we can't sort of, because I think the first instinct was with the amount of time is, do we just recycle or, you know, reuse some of the existing rugby stories that you mentioned? But the decision was, because it's such a big thing and the sponsorship is so cool, that we should come up with fresh execution. So I think I think that the brief had there was the informal part of the brief, which I think was, you sort of almost describe as the meta brief, which was this acknowledgement that perhaps where we had taken the storytelling, and also in rugby with great scripts like Gareth Thomas and even David and Goliath, that we were becoming perhaps a bit austere and a bit somber, that we would be looking to inject a bit more joy, a bit more energy, just a bit of a positivity. So that, I think, was the first meta. That was the brief hovering over the brief. And we quickly settled on what Craig touched on, that we were looking to tell some stories that differentiated the Six Nations rugby from rugby in general. So I think where Craig is right, that rugby has a very strong ethos, possibly because it was an amateur game for so long, of camaraderie and togetherness, and that you are able to be that rival fans can travel in the same train to and from the game, that people are able to drink together in the same pubs, that there was this very friendly attitude ethos in rugby. But what made the Six Nations special is that, of course, this is played, it's close neighbors. And as a result, the rivalries, because of the history of France and England and Wales and England and Ireland and England, et cetera, that those rivalries were even more intense. But because most people are married to each other, they, you know, you share family, you share neighbors in some places, you even share a pub across the border, that consequently the friendships were even bigger. So that sort of idea of fierce rivals and better friends became the prism through which we were trying to find the stories.
So how did you go about that? Because the stories that you landed on are amazing. And I'm just wondering, do you guys put out an APB for great stories? Is that happening within the creative department, or is it all hands on deck? And how do you end up getting to the people that end up getting featured?
I think that Nudge and I, over the years working on Guinness, you sort of truffle hunt for these stories. So you're always on the lookout for something that just sparks your, that could be a great Guinness story. And the truth is that it is a little bit of all hands on deck, everybody sourcing the sort of the raw material that can you spin this into a myth? Can you spin this into a fable and draw out the tale we want to tell from the raw material of a true story? And I think with the two ones that we made, the old Harriet and the Miller Mills sisters, was a sort of a gift that just fell into our lap of the strategy, because of course they're sisters who grew up together, played rugby together, and by the sort of the quirk of the United Kingdom were eligible to play for two different countries, Scotland and England, and so met each other, collided, and actually did play, took the field in the different shirts and sort of played against each other. And then of course they still sisters and huge friends. So that just felt like a gift of a story to tell. And so when we saw this story of the dear old mum who had left sort of the strict instructions and inheritance in her will that the brothers had to spend all of their inheritance watching the rugby, traveling around together, watching the rugby. It just felt to us like riding on top of that strategy was just a wonderful story about all the best things in life. That, of course, with what is the best thing to do with money? It's to live a life together, to do the thing you love, and to do it in sort of joyous communion. And that gave us a story structure to be able to send these brothers to each country, and as a result have the rivalry as they watch the game with their opponents, but then have all of that friendship as they celebrate in the pubs afterwards together. So they both felt like gifts of to give our ethos of our view of rugby.
But were they gifts that emerged from 30 stories, or were they gifts that
yes, there's a lot of sifting.
I can imagine, because the two Welsh brothers, to me, it struck me that these were not only real life, they were living this story in real life, because it's a true story, but they were actually pretty damn good actors.
They, I mean, I don't know if I'm telling tales, but there was a lot of, well, I wouldn't say a long process because it was a very quick process to go to filming, but I think that we started with the assumption when we were making it, we had the sort of the bias that we'd of course have to cast actors because and the director is very, very good. Snuck them into the casting session because he had a hunch that they would be good. And so when we were looking at the casting tape, they were not presented to us as the real brothers. They were just two people auditioning for the part, and they were so compelling that we all sort of said, this is going to be worth the risk. But credit to our director Tom Green, well, let's put it this way. It was easier for them to give a natural performance because of course they love going to rugby and having a Guinness in a pub. It's not a hell of a lot of acting they need to do with that. Yeah, but he was right. He was so good at just reintroducing them to the wonder of their own story and actually how deeply they loved and felt their mum and how much they were honoring her memory by making this film. And he really drew that poignancy out of them. So they sort of gave the performance of their lifetime, but through this director who was so good and so sensitive.
I particularly loved the scene where they're in the taxi and one of the brothers, one of the Reese brothers, notices how much it's costing and he goes, "What?" It's so fantastic. I mean, I was like, oh my God, that guy's brilliant. Fantastic.
Our mom was different. In her will, she left us strict instructions to spend every last penny on the Six Nations. Mum loved the intensity, the rivalry, and the way it was all forgotten afterwards. This was her purse.
That's a pretty purse.
We keep the kitty in it. It pays for our pints. Wherever we go, the purse goes. And every trip we make, every game we see, it's like Mom's here with us. Love you, Mom.
Hey, I say, Allison, was it a deliberate decision to sort of evolve away from the stories that were rooted in sort of elite players and then to evolve into more the fan stories from fans? Or was that a creative coincidence? Just happened to be a coincidence?
No, I think the decision that we wanted to tell the stories of fans and truly connect to people so that they felt like Guinness was for them, Guinness's view on rugby was for them, that was a deliberate part of the briefing and the strategy. And as Nick said earlier, that idea of a Guinness story that had warmth and joy and wasn't so somber was important to us. We look back at our very deep and wonderful Guinness archive of brilliant ads all the time, probably to Nick's annoyance, although he made the best of them. And we looked at the ones that we really feel endured through the time, and they have a lot of joy in them. So there are things like looking back at, there's an ad called Swim Black, which was the tonal reference that we asked the guys to work with, which has got surprise and joy and unexpectedness in it, and just felt like the kind of feeling you'd like to have when watching rugby was essentially the thinking.
So Nick, for you, are you a writer or art director originally, or how would you describe yourself?
As the writer for sure. My partner, Daniel is very much the art director, and we conceptualize together, but of course I do the writing when it comes to it.
So
we do it together.
How did you approach writing these real, because these are true stories that have to be written well.
For Purse and Sisters, we were the creative directors on that. But I can talk to the writing of the David and Goliath and the Shane Williams, the early rugby stuff, and of course the Purse, which is sort of a similar thing.
Yes.
You're looking for the you're looking for the fable, you're looking for the myth within the true story, and you're trying to spin a fable, a view on life. And with the Munster versus the All Blacks, it's, I suppose, it's the oldest story in the world. It's overcoming the monster, and he's trying to filter the facts through that viewpoint. And Shane Williams, which of course was all, he's this little guy who was told he would never make it into rugby.
Yeah,
you're just trying to tease out the enduring truth beneath the facts. And I think that Tim Riley, who wrote the Sisters and the Purse, was sort of essentially doing the same thing. That this is the fable of what is so special about rugby. That it's so damn special that a mother would put it in her will that, you know, that you have to go and enjoy your life. You have to go and watch this rugby, and you build that myth outwards that way.
Yeah, it turned into like the epic journey, really, yeah. But one that was just full of good times and connection to others. That I think I love that about this film, The Purse. It's an epic story. It's got death. It's got life. It's got joy. It's got strangers. It's got intimacy. I think the guys did an amazing job with that.
So how does that extend? These are terrific films that are you know, they're promoted on various platforms. How do you extend, or did you extend those stories, or in what way did that campaign move beyond the film?
For a little while with Made of More, we'd got to a really interesting structure once you had true stories, because true stories give you depth. And Nick and Nadja had pioneered it a little bit with Sapeurs, where there was a documentary that sat behind that, which received a huge amount of attention in its own right. We did a similar kind of thing with Purse, with the brothers having been in the film. They were then able to, you know, be a really strong focus for a number of PR efforts, where they could be interviewed and talked to about kind of their lives and how it all worked, which gave a tremendous authenticity to it all. But then we had the broader canvas as well of rugby in general and Six Nations. So we were putting together the content that came out of the sponsorship also. So podcasts with kind of veteran players talking about the tournament and their relationship with it. We were able to exploit, you know, people's connections with rugby across the whole social ecosystem. So producing content and things that would enable them to show their kind of affiliation as fans. And then we created spaces and places where people could enjoy the game as well. Particular kind of, modern venues like Flatiron Square in London, where you could totally own that place in terms of branding and creating the kind of more interesting modern experiences that people are looking for now, rather than the kind of, you know, TV in the corner of a dusty old pub. We could really enhance the actual experience of watching the game as well.
What did you think, Nick? I mean, were there things that naturally rolled out of the films that you thought had legs in social and in events, et cetera? Did it take a little extra work to try to find a way to make it apply?
I think that the reality with the Guinness pint side for the Six Nations is that it was probably more built in terms of going into social and all around. That was built more along the ideas of friends and rivals. So yeah. The Purse is a good story, but, you know, but and so is Sisters, but they're different stories. And, you know, it is, we are, of course, you're talking to us, and we're AMV, and we're greedy, and so we'll take the accolades. But you know, Guinness works with wonderful social and other agencies who were also responsible for activating. So we are social, and a lot of the guys taking in great social ideas. But in this case, less with the brothers and the sisters, and probably more on the sharp idea of friends and rivals coming together.
So one of the things that struck me, we talked about this towards the end of the last episode, is women in Guinness advertising. And so we see that here in terrific ways. And even though I think that Liberty Fields ran a little bit later, it seems like the right time in our conversation to talk about it. Can Allison talk about what was the strategic goal with Liberty Fields, and what is Liberty Fields?
So Liberty Fields
strategically.
So Liberty Fields is the film that we made about the first Japanese Rugby World Cup playing team in the women's game. It came from one of those wonderful story searches that Nick was talking about earlier, where we were looking for, in that case, a story that was about how people together overcome barriers. So we were looking for something that wasn't an isolated hero figure story. Yeah. We were looking for something that showed that together we are more made of more. And in this case, that story of the Japanese women's rugby team perfectly fitted the narrative that we had seen work so powerfully through rugby before, which is about somebody taking on what looks like an insurmountable barrier. In this case, the Japanese women's rugby team were expected to be well-behaved Japanese ladies as was the norm in their time. And actually what they found was joy and freedom and companionship and great success coming together as a rugby team and having the freedom and life that that brings.
Some saw us as strange. As troublemakers. As an embarrassment. All we ever saw was a team.
It was a story of the vein of some of the others that we've seen. We actually went out not looking for a women's story. We went out looking for a group story, and the story of these Japanese women just sings through because it has that extra depth and that extra unexpectedness of being about women rugby players, which was brilliant for us as a brand. Some of the stuff we talked about at the beginning of this whole session was about how there's a sort of regressive masculinity that can cloud beer. And actually by being part of celebrating women in sport, and especially in such a physical sport as rugby, Guinness in itself was starting to appear more dynamic, which we'll certainly take that.
So Nick, with Liberty Fields, it wasn't really friends and rivals. It was a little bit of a more of a celebration of success, I suppose, and overcoming. It's probably about unexpected character too, or maybe some of the earlier thoughts. But where did you come at it from? Or because it was a different execution.
Yes, and I think that it's interesting because it may have, in the chronology of development, it probably preceded a little bit of the Six Nations, because it was being conceived sort of in the shadow of the upcoming World Cup that was played in Japan. So it probably was sort of straddled a little bit of the overcoming and people of character within a team environment versus a more overt expression of joy and the fans that we were going for in the Six Nations. But I think that what we like to do, and I think what's been rich for us with the Guinness storytelling is over the past, is that we don't sort of hold up a mirror to to faces. We hold up a mirror to the identifiable storylines. And suppose we're holding up a mirror to anybody who's ever wanted to just fancy themselves up and head down for the pub to be a little, to feel a little bit more special. And that's a truth that we all live by. And I think what was wonderful about the sisters is that we've all been told we aren't allowed to do something. We've all been told that this is not our place.
Yeah.
And we've all realized and experienced the joy of when we actually overturn those things and we do it together. And what a rich and empowering and wonderful feeling that is. And that's really the story that we were just trying to tell, which is, of course, ultimately what rugby is about, because rugby is played by the big guys in the front row and the big women in the front row, the string beans and this, in the middle of the scrum, and then the small, quick little people in the back line. So it does take people that are perhaps not physically put up to an ideal or have, are different, but are so much stronger as a team.
So it fits perfectly in with that thought of carving your own path, which is, made of more. That's the spirit of Made of More.
Yeah.
So let's turn to the great Guinness Clear campaign. And I'm just wondering, Craig, because I was intrigued by it because there was a number of brands that were dealing with this issue, and I didn't know whether there was some new legislation, that some new regulations that were coming in place. Why was there a heightened emphasis on this topic? And then the topic being of, how would you label this? I suppose it's
drinking
about
responsibly.
Drinking responsibly. Thank you. Why had that become an increased emphasis at that time? And this again was around the same time as the cup, rugby cup.
I'm not sure I would say it was of increased emphasis necessarily. It's something that's been important to Diageo across their portfolio of brands for some time, and something that, as I say, we take very seriously. I think what we had in front of us with the sponsorship opportunity around the Six Nations was just a great opportunity to tell that story at greater volume and when it would really matter and make a difference, because we know that watching sporting events is often a time when people might be tempted to drink more than they perhaps should. And it was a moment where we knew that we might be able to make a real difference, and having a commitment to trying to help people, not drink more, but to choose better brands when they did drink, and to also, help moderate their intake if they wanted to and when they wanted to, was a great role that Guinness could play at that point.
So for you, Alison, what was it from your side of the table?
I think for an alcohol brand to be involved in sport, you need to know that you're doing your best to do no harm. And that, as Craig said, is core to Diageo's marketing theory, that you must apply your best efforts in advertising and storytelling to help people understand how to drink responsibly and enjoy your products without harm. And our job, as we sat down to this brief, to the responsible drinking brief, was to decide which was the most powerful story we could tell and how we could have the most impact with it, as in how we could make the most people think about how to drink responsibly.
And I would add to that as well. It's sometimes taken on as an obligation, not with Diageo, but you see it sometimes kind of in the world elsewhere when you sort of kind of go, okay, we need to put this message out, and it's put out in a relatively rational way and in a way which is sort of, fulfilling an obligation, maybe ticking a box. And I think what we saw here was an opportunity to do something much more creative with it, to have much more fun with it, to really elevate this message to the same status as any great Guinness brand message, and to be able to kind of take that responsibility and do some good with it rather than just kind of tick a box or fulfill an obligation.
And it was I think the biggest thing about it was a standalone campaign. I mean, Crown Royal has done something similar to this. Is that a Diageo brand, by the way?
Yeah, it is.
It is. Okay. So Crown Royal, I don't know if it was in the UK or in Europe, but it's been running. It is running over here. And just
Boys.
Like, what was that?
Yeah. The Water Boys, isn't it?
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And it was And it, like your campaign, is a standalone campaign. And I didn't know whether sort of hydration is a completely different way of going after responsible drinking than what has typically gone before it. Was that a strategic idea that was shaped by Guinness, or was that a Diageo strategy shift?
It wasn't a Diageo strategy shift. Diageo looks at various strands of responsible drinking, everything from our Formula One sponsorship looks at drink drive messaging, for example.
Right.
Some of our in countries, they'll have the whole portfolio getting behind something like A Pleasure Never to Drink and Drive. So when we took on this brief on Guinness, we looked at all the various options, and there was something about the nature of the idea of taking another drink and making it water that felt, or Guinness, I guess it's got more to it rather than being a sort of telling people what to do, telling people what not to do. And I think that really appealed to us.
So Nick, you, again, somebody knocks on your door, you're part of a conversation. I mean, it's amazing where you ended up with this. You got to give us some great detail on how the hell that happened.
a name you'll often hear is Tim Riley, who we were sort of working on the brief, and he and Dave Edwards was also working on it at AMV, and they were talking about water, and Tim was just sort of came to us and said, well, why don't we rebrand water as this amazing new product, Guinness Clear? And it's one of those ideas where it's sort of the whole world just opens up before you, because it's he said, let's just rebrand it and treat it as a new product launch. And immediately you can just see all the things that you can do. And what makes it such a perfect fit for us is that you do need a brand that is so iconic in order to subvert it. You can't, it takes a brand with such strong mental landscape, you know, because we all can visualize what a real Guinness is. We all know all of that iconography. We know, have such strong memories in our heads of what it is, that it takes a brand that strong and that sort of powerful in people's ideas to be able to subvert it. And then, of course, it takes people that are brave enough and willing to sort of rib themselves and be self-deprecating about themselves. So you sort of, when we went back, we were sort of going, are we a bit nuts? But it was just, it was accepted. And the ideas just kind of come flowing from it, because it's a true big idea.
So, and the genius of it, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that you made it Guinness Clear. You didn't run a campaign for Clear and then at the end just sort of say, brought to you by Guinness. It was Guinness Clear. That was the genius for me.
It was interesting, because I think that was from the outset. It was just, you just can be upfront about it. It's so odd that you can just go for it. You just play it with a straight, almost play it with a straight bat, as we would say here, using a cricket analogy. But you can just, you just pretend like you're launching a new Guinness product and do it the way you would with any, and own up to it.
And the tropes of beer advertising,
yes,
and particularly, I guess, a little bit craft beer. Let's sneak that in there. Were so ripe for having some fun with.
Yes,
just a joy to see them come rolling out. You know. Bearded hipsters appreciating it. Aproned brewers telling you how you make it and what to drink. And it just was, as Nick said, it seemed like you could just literally turn on the tap and the ideas came out on this one once you had that core thought.
So Nick, can you explain for the listener, and we'll bake the spot into the recording, but for those who aren't on the episode page and who are just listening to this as an independent podcast, can you tell us what Guinness Clear is? What was the idea?
Well, in order to encourage people to have a glass of water while they are out, instead of saying have water, we thought that it would be way more enticing and way more seductive to offer somebody a glass, to get them to have a glass of Guinness Clear, which we sort of advertised and sort of brought out into the world as this brand new product extension from Guinness, which would be Guinness Clear, which was made from 100% H2O. And it was made in the exact same care and attention. But of course, as the voiceover is reminding you in the ad, it's not really beer. It's actually water. So it was just a pure rebranding of boring old tap water into something awesome. Because we thought that if you wanted to, the best way to stop somebody from drinking a Guinness was to encourage them to drink another type of Guinness.
A flavor unlike anything else. A look all of its own. Made to a time-honored recipe. What else tastes like it? Nothing. So clear. Make it a night you'll remember. With new Guinness Clear.
And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to change behavior here, which is you're trying to encourage people to drink responsibly by drinking water in between a couple of beers.
Correct.
And you know, one of the things that struck me, and I don't know, you guys probably, I don't know if you have it in the UK, but the brewmaster looks like Stephen Colbert's brother. You know Stephen Colbert?
Yes.
Was that, maybe he's a twin, I don't know.
He just seemed to have, I mean, we certainly didn't make the Colbert link, but he has that kind of faux pompousness that I think Colbert cultivates very well. There's something deeply earnest about the way he lovingly looks at his glass of water, Guinness Clear, with such authenticity.
Yeah, he really does.
He believes in his part, doesn't he?
So tell us about one of the other things that's so great about it is that you kind of play with the rituals. You transfer and you sort of reflect the rituals of pouring a pint of Guinness, and then you play with that for clear. Like tell us about the two part pour and those other Liffey and other examples.
Yes, we were able to have so much fun and again, with the beer tropes, but also with some of the Guinness tropes, so that letting the water settle as the part of the two part pour for a Guinness, so that before you just fill it up at the end, where there would be a two part pour, or said we could, you know, the first part would just be turn on the tap, and the second part would just be fill it up, and we could offer it an extra cold by just dropping in a few blocks of ice. and also, you know, if it's a, you know, this bold new taste, you could have it in a full pint, but of course if you're a little bit sort of unsure about what you were getting and you just wanted to try it, you could try it in a half a glass of clear. And then you have that sort of slightly fun way of, you know, we've all seen the case studies for how big launch has happened, so there's always a big stunt. So we thought that we would, as a big sort of product, hey, we're here, stunt, but you could take the Liffey River, which runs through Dublin, and actually just fill it up with Guinness Clear, you know, so that the whole city would be flowing with Guinness Clear. Recipes that you would, you know, because the cooking culture and, you know, drinks and food go together so well. So we'd get Michelin starred restaurants to show you how to cook with Guinness Clear. and of course, you encourage people to try it at home. So we made home brew kits for Guinness Clear, which was just a sort of a glass and with instructions of putting it under the tap and turning the tap on.
Yeah, it's just incredible. The product extension idea with just, you know, cold, with add ice cubes. That was just fantastic. So, yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Alison.
Well, I was talking to our licensing guys. So Guinness is lucky. It's a brand that sells a lot of stuff on licensing. People like having a Guinness t-shirt or a Guinness hat, right? But they were saying the single biggest search they got last year was for Guinness ponchos, which was because we gave fans in the ground when it was raining a Guinness Clear poncho to keep the Guinness Clear off them. Our consumers wanted to buy them and were very disappointed that we didn't have them. So it really captured people's imagination, this.
And the line on the poncho was, "It's raining Guinness Clear," which I was, thought was very, very funny.
Yeah. And, you know, and this was interesting because this was, well, certainly our brothers had a humor in it. This sort of took it to a whole new level. I mean, this was like chuckling out loud sort of humor. It feels sort of new for Guinness to have that level of humor. Or am I missing? I mean, it was a different type of humor here. Or am I interpreting it in the wrong way?
There's been a playful humor that's run through Guinness communication all the way back, actually. I mean, if you look in the archive, you know, even to the kind of classic Gilroy cartoons, there's amusement there. And I think in some ways we had been perhaps a little guilty of becoming a little too somber and a little too meaningful and a little too sort of self-absorbed, albeit with work that had been extraordinarily successful at those times. But this was, in some ways, yes, of course, it's laugh-out-loud humour, which Guinness hadn't done so much of before. But it was just a reconnection, I think, with the playful side of the brand, which has always been there and is always there, of course, in the Irish roots as well. And the thing we kind of talk about, the little twinkle in the eye that the brand has, where it's sort of allowed to be a little bit more playful at times.
No doubt. It's phenomenal work. And what a credit to the brand and the way that it literally extended into so many different places. I particularly loved seeing some of the photographs of the hydration stations. Can you guys, Nick, can you tell us about this idea of how the idea came to life at the actual games and at the pubs around the games, these backpacks?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure, you know, at rugby stadiums, there's always people walking around offering you drinks, and so we had the free Guinness Clear sort of guy, people walking around with the big backpacks, you know, to try Guinness Clear. There was in the bathrooms a sort of copy about how to, you know, that you might consider trying a Guinness Clear. There was obviously the ponchos that Alison mentioned that you could wear because it's the Six Nations, it's in February, it's in the United Kingdom and Ireland, it is going to rain. And also the just the amazing sort of scale that you have with the sponsorship, all the hoardings around the pitch and the big screen in the stadium was real estate for us to use. And in the sort of the Surge bars and the sort of the Guinness bars, we had the sort of the little taps of Guinness Clear that were set aside as well, that you could go in. So there was a lot of fun presence there.
Yeah, really, really terrific stuff. So let's talk a little bit about, before we get into the ROI aspects of things, can we talk about, to the degree that you can you share with us where things go from here for the brand, Alison? Where do you kind of see things going? Do they continue along the same strategic direction, or do you see an evolution coming somehow?
I think you can imagine what the answer is going to be, Fergus.
Yeah, I can imagine.
We continue to move, and actually we're very excited with the work that has been happening, that is going to happen next. The brand has taken on board that learning, actually, about the warmth and the joy and the humour. We want to be as inviting as possible. It's easy for Guinness to be a bit overpowering, and actually opening up the brand, inviting more people in, is spurring us on to think again about what more we can do. The next chapter of Made of More will be an evolution again. This terrible 2020 year, the team at AMV have been amazing about making Guinness relevant, giving it a beauty that we haven't had for a while, showing people new things to think about Guinness, such as drinking it at home when it's been such an iconic pub drink. So we've had to take on quite a lot of challenges, but it's making us stronger overall, and we're going to emerge out of this even better.
I love it. You know, throughout our conversation, Craig and Allison have both referred back to those sort of core brand values or attributes. I'm not sure how to label them, but those the three were power, goodness, and communion. And I've definitely gotten the sense for goodness and communion. And I'm just kind of curious, what is what do you want power to mean? What does power mean for the brand?
I mean, it's one of the things that we've talked about a huge amount in this period when we've had a chance to reflect on the brand and what it is and what it will need to be in the future. And I think one of the most interesting things that we've done in recent times is to inextricably connect power and communion and put those two together to say, if we've seen anything in the last 6 months in this dreadful year that we've all experienced, it's the wonderful power that comes from informal connections of people and people coming together, often in times when they can't physically be together. And that sense of the power that comes from communion, you know, we even see it in things like the kind of protest movements that have happened around the world as well. And that's where we see a huge opportunity for this brand going forward, is that kind of wonderful, interesting, fluid power that can come from groups of people, perhaps informally connecting, perhaps spontaneously connecting, you know, the power that comes from the connections between us. And that's one of the strands that we're definitely following as we begin to go on our next stage of the creative.
So Nick, can you were not a part of the first conversation, the first episode, but can you give us your sort of a sense of, from a creative's perspective, of how the brand is, you know, a quick overview of how you feel the brand has evolved creatively? You know, we talked in the first episode, for example, about the evolution from good things come to those who wait, and what the strategic challenges were in that in terms of what it was trying to solve. And then I think we all kind of felt that it was like this jarring move to try and find another direction or another sort of a brand expression. And there were some ups and downs in getting to Made of More. What has the journey been like for you and creatives in terms of that evolution? Have you found more joy in the recent work than the previous work, or have they been challenging in different ways?
I think that on a personal thing, that it's challenging precisely because it's Guinness, and I think that there are a few brands out in the world that when you sort of asked to step up and take it on, you feel the weight of the brilliance that has come before you, and you feel a responsibility to live up to it. And it's quite nerve-wracking, and you take that responsibility seriously. So, but I've personally, and I think that our department has had lots of success, and lots of fruit has flowered from Made of More. I think that there is always, if the truth is told, there is a sort of an echelon of some people out in the advertising community who like to sort of go, oh well, you know, good things come to those who sort of sit in the past. And I think that we have learned to move on from that. And to create our and for AMV and Guinness to create new iconic work that has stood the test of time in a number of occasions. And the evolution is a weird sort of wheel, because I think we would like to return to a little bit more of the joy and the wit. I think that we probably got a little bit austere or a little bit somber, and I think that we are returned to the joy and the wit of a Swim Black, and maybe the swagger and the energy of a Suppose would do us good to rediscover some of that. So the wheel should turn in that direction, but the wheel should go forward, and it is time for reimagining how we tell Made of More, how we bring that metamorph world to life, I think that we probably could all do, we could all reinvigorate it and find new wonderful places to go. Because ultimately that, I think, is what has stood the test of time, is being able to, is the reinvention. So,
yeah, I mean, it seems
intimidating, but exciting.
And it always seems to be, which is the way we, I think we all want all of our work to be, which is reflective of what's coming next. And I think when you look back at Mind Over Matter, Irrepressible Spirit, and some of those, some of the stories that may have been a little bit more somber, but they were happening during a time when those types of stories were driving culture. And you guys switched just I think ahead of when it began to switch too. So that's I think it's almost a credit, whether it's strategically structured that way or it's coincidental. There does seem to be that sort of ability for the brand to be ahead of culture. I mean, it's that sort of cliche of people saying, do brands create culture or does culture create brands? I don't know what you think, Allison, if you're ahead of it for, you're ahead of it by luck or you're ahead of it by design?
Probably a combination of the two, I'm sure. But you're dead right. We have to be the brand that people need us to be in the moment that we're in. And that requires us to understand the culture around us and the shifts that are happening within it. These are very interesting times, and they will continue to be very interesting times. And we need to make sure that Guinness feels really relevant and inviting within them.
So, Craig, can you close us out with sort of a summary of the ROI and the results, so that we? I know it's a very in-depth story, so, and I know that there's certain things you can't say, but can you give us a sense of, in looking back at the three parts of this, how things progressed and where we ended up? Because the results are phenomenal.
Yes. Onto the numbers, which is always the best bit.
Yeah,
I mean, it's been a story of commitment to consistency, but to achieving reinvention and creativity within it. And I think those two things together have delivered extraordinary results. I mean, what we've seen through the evolution of Made of More since the beginning with Clock and Cloud is an almost kind of relentless, ever-increasing set of revenue and profit ROI figures across GB and Ireland. And those numbers, there's been a few small ups and downs here and there, but pretty much it's a rising curve. And the top of that curve was Guinness Clear, which achieved, I mean, absolute record-breaking ROI, both in terms of GB and Ireland, largely because of the nature of the campaign, with it being a kind of PR-driven activation. When those things take off, your ROI goes stratospheric because the in media investment is magnified by so much due to the coverage that it takes on. We were achieving, you know, revenue ROIs of £52 for every pound we spent in GB and over €100 for every euro we spent in Ireland.
That's hard.
And that kind of ROI on those numbers, I mean, but those kinds of ROI numbers are not unusual in Ireland, given the scale of the brand and the ubiquity of the distribution over there. And also, to be frank, the cost of the media as well in comparison to GB. So the ROI numbers are extraordinary, and it's that sense of continually beating our best and continually pushing forward, but committing to do so within an idea that became more and more familiar to people over time. And we've been able to do a number of things with running work at different stages. So, for example, in GB, we've just been running Suppers again. And, you know, I happened to catch it on TV the other night, and it looks as wonderful and fresh as it did at the beginning. Mm. You know, these are films that can live absolutely with a sense of what the brand is, because Made of More has lived through that period. And, you know, having the ability to kind of go back into your archive during a time when making exciting, fresh, new content has been harder than ever, but being able to pluck something of the power of Suppers and put it back on air,
yeah,
and then see it generate, you know, almost twice the level of ROI as it did at the beginning because of the ad stock that you've developed behind the idea. It's just been awesome. And then what we were able to do with this paper was to look, but the IPO paper was to look back across the whole life of this idea and understand its kind of cumulative impact since 2012. And the numbers, they were the kind of numbers that when you started to look at them, I remember Lisa, who is the strategy director on the brand, Lisa and I, when we were looking at the paper originally and getting the data in, we started to wonder if we had our zeros in the wrong place. And this point, so we're like, I think I've done this some, but can you check it for me? Because I'm not sure it can be right. But what we were able to do was to compare the average ROI we were getting from work before Made of More began with the actual ROIs we got once Made of More was happening. And so that gave us a baseline of saying, if we invested this media money against less good ideas, but you still invested the media money, what returns would you get? And then to compare that figure with the actual returns we got by investing that media money against Made of More. And the kind of delta was extraordinary. And when we looked at it across those 8 years or 7 or 8 years, it was a difference of £1 billion in that period cumulatively. And that is not, as I say, the value of the return on the media investment. That is the value of the idea. That's the value of the creativity. That's the value of thinking. Not just that kind of brute force of media spend return, which you can get a degree of simply by putting your logo up there. This was about the kind of increment you get from a great idea versus an average idea. And that was just an extraordinary learning.
And for further details on the ROI, folks can probably eventually get to look at the published case study through the IPA Awards. And I believe that's published in book form following the awards, right?
Yes, it's published in book form. It's already available online. You can find it via the IPA website. It's all available to be downloaded and all kind of publicly available and projected.
It's up on Walk.
Terrific. Everybody, thank you. Each of you, Craig, Allison, and Nick, thanks for joining today, Nick, and to Craig and Allison for being a part of the first episode. It's just a brilliant journey. I know you guys are proud of it. It's getting the accolades that it deserves, and the creativity continues to be extraordinary. And all credit to, I think, the great insights that come from the client side too. I just recently did an episode with Stephen O'Kelly and Tim Jones, and we did one for Smirnoff, for the launch of Smirnoff, and I mentioned it there, and I'll mention it again here, that for Diageo, having planners on the client side, planners who go beyond research, and it just really makes a huge, it appears to make a huge difference to the end product that there's a really strong partnership coming from Diageo's planners as well as agency people. So, and it's been a thrill to have you on, Allison, and you guys are brilliant. Thank you. And you inspire a lot of people, and I appreciate you being a part of this, this showcase.
That's so good of you to say.
Thank you very much.
It's great talking to you.
And we will see everybody on the next episode. Thanks again, guys. Have a great evening.
Okay, thank you. Bye.